This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org. Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoi, and this is The Exchange. It happens every 10 years with the clockwork regularity of the U.S. Census. Legal and political battles erupt over the redrawing of representative districts for Congress and other elected offices. Control of redistricting process has long been viewed as the spoils of victory when one political party gains control of a state legislature. But in recent years, concerns have grown that the resultant safe seats deprive our political system of the benefits of true electoral competition and may violate the basic voting rights of some American citizens. As a result, some states have entrusted the process to independent or bipartisan commissions and judges. And what was originally intended as a means of addressing legitimate demographic shifts in population across the country has become a contentious fight over the use of cutting-edge mapping technology to hardwire incumbency and partisan advantage into our system of representation. Today on The Exchange, Rethinking Redistricting. Let's hear from you. Do you think redistricting has hurt Congress and the political process? What concerns do you have over the protection of voting rights? How would you reform the process of determining representative districts? Do you think that reform is even necessary at all? You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. I have two guests joining me today to talk about redistricting. Joining me from Worcester, Mass. Is Robert Boatwright. Robert is an associate professor of political science at Clark University. Professor Boatwright has written extensively on topics including congressional redistricting, campaign finance reform, interest groups, and political participation. Rob, welcome to The Exchange. Rob, are you with us?
I'm with you. I'm right here.
Good morning.
All right. Good morning.
Also joining me this morning from New York is Michael Lee. Mr. Lee serves as legal counsel for the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. His work focuses on redistricting, voting rights, and elections. And Michael, thank you for joining us for The Exchange.
Yep, absolutely. Happy to be here.
Gentlemen, let's start with a few definitional issues. The process we're describing really concerns three interrelated concepts, reapportionment, redistricting, and gerrymandering. And Rob, let me start with you. Can you sort out the differences and connections between those three terms for our listeners?
Sure. Reapportionment is the decision made every decade based on census results to grant the states a number of seats in the House of Representatives based on their population. Redistricting is the drawing of the actual districts that the representatives each state is entitled to will represent. Gerrymandering is a much less precise term that is subjective. When congressional districts are drawn in most states, legislatures have the authority to draw them in whatever way they see fit as long as they have equal population and are contiguous. So if a party wishes to draw districts that will give them the maximum number of seats possible or will benefit some other party criterion, that is often referred to as gerrymandering.
And Michael, what are the legal dimensions of these concepts? You know, people talk about gerrymandering being illegal, but what is kind of the legal basis for these concepts in our process?
Well, you know, the thing about redistricting is that there really aren't a lot of rules that govern it. You know, at the top level, you do have the rules that say districts have to have the same number of people and they can't discriminate against ethnic minorities. You also have requirements in the Voting Rights Act that mandate drawing majority-minority districts in certain instances, but really there aren't a lot of other rules beyond that, and that's been one of the problems. The Supreme Court has never actually come up with a standard for what is partisan gerrymandering, even though everyone recognizes that it exists. It just hasn't found a workable rule, and some of the justices don't think that the court should even get involved in that. And so that's really one of the problems. Everybody knows that it exists, but it's really, really hard to police.
And Michael, as redistricting counsel, what sorts of clearly you're saying there's no standard for legal standard for gerrymandering, a specific one. But what kinds of arguments do you typically hear when this gets into the legal realm?
Well, you know, most gerrymandering cases, oftentimes involve race. Particularly in places like Texas, which are growing very fast and are changing. And so there is a clear body of law dealing with what happens when you have different racial groups and how you balance out power and when groups need to be protected and when they're being discriminated against. So there's a lot of litigation on that. When you get into the other area, people have tried to frame gerrymandering in terms of the Equal Protection Clause under the 14th Amendment, or maybe it's you're affecting my right of free association by putting me in a district that's not my natural community or something like that. There really is a bit of a struggle trying to find a standard that will both work and that the court will ultimately accept. And I think with the court seeming to step away from wanting to have racial remedies, I think, there's a lot of interest among advocates and people in this field, reformers, to find a workable framework.
Mm-hmm. Rob, we know that in some states the legislature controls the process. Other states have commissions and judges. Could you say a little bit about the landscape for redistricting? What is kind of the balance between these different political and legal approaches to redistricting?
In most American states, the legislature is in charge. There's been a growing movement towards having citizen commissions, but there are only about five or six of these nationally. In some cases, the legislature will be given specific directives. For instance, here in Massachusetts, the legislature is told to avoid splitting up towns unless it's absolutely necessary. So there are degrees of legislative autonomy in doing this, and for the most part, governors will need to sign off on the legislative plan, so there's often the same sort of negotiation that we see with legislation at the federal level that state house, state senate have to compromise on things and reach a deal with the governor.
Yeah, I think the figure I've seen is something like 35 or 36 states use the state legislatures. And obviously, there are some states where there's only one representative, right. So it's not an issue. But Michael, your sense of the kind of the trade-offs between state legislatures and these do these bipartisan commissions or leaving it to judges, do you think that they really solve the issues that we're going to talk about some problems in a moment? But how do you think they work?
Sure. I think the jury is still a little bit out on them. Redistricting commissions are a relatively new creature. The oldest one dates back to the 1970s, but most of them are more recent than that. And I think what can be said is that while there isn't a lot of evidence about if they really performed that much better, I think it is certainly the case that they don't seem to have performed worse than leaving it in the hands of politicians. In fact, commission-drawn maps seem to thus far have resulted in less litigation and to have resulted in somewhat more competitive districts. So from a from that standpoint, they seem to have worked. And also from a process standpoint, the commissions do seem to have done a better job of fostering public participation. A lot of times when you leave it to the legislature, it's the subject of a lot of backroom deals. People don't really get a chance to see the maps or to comment on them or to make suggested changes, and the commission seemed to do a much better job of at least allowing the public to participate and to have a much more deliberative process, which I think is a healthy thing.
So we're talking about an improved process. We're talking about redistricting today on The Exchange. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Redistricting.org. And Rob, I want to talk a little bit about the technological landscape. We hear a lot about the process becoming increasingly sophisticated, literally down to the individual residence or street. Could you talk a little bit about how this the process is sort of carried out from a technical perspective?
How the redistricting process?
Yeah, that's sort of the software, the technology, how they literally do it.
Well, geographic mapping software was available during the 2000 and 2002 round of redistricting, but was not really accessible to the public. So we know that both political parties invested a lot of money in developing maps and consulting with state legislatures about this. What we saw in the last round of redistricting is that the software is available to pretty much anyone. So there were a large number of competing maps that were out there in the individual states. In many states, interested members of the public were able to draw maps. In some instances, proposed maps were put out on the web that citizens could comment on or not. So the process has really been opened up, which in one sense is a good thing in that citizens can scrutinize everything that the legislature is doing. On the other hand, it enables state legislatures to fine-tune their maps much more. So if they wish to draw a map that advantages one party or the other, they can do this with much more precision than used to be possible. Mm-hmm.
Michael, your insight on the process?
Well, there's no question that technology has become really, really sophisticated in the level of data that is available, down to the block level, makes it really possible to draw maps that you can very accurately in the first few years after the maps take effect predict what the election result is going to be if you were intending to do that. And so, it's a really powerful tool, and I think that that is one of the reasons why you see an increased interest in reform that at least tries to place some rules on or constraints on what legislators can do with that, or perhaps even take the power out of their hands to draw the maps, because it is such a powerful tool that they have now.
So what kind of constraints are you talking about? You're saying that there may be some potential constraints on how the parties can use this software.
Well, not so much how they use the software, but what kind of maps they can draw. So, for example, in Florida, voters there in 2010 passed a constitutional amendment that left redistricting in the hands of the legislature, but said, here are the rules that you have to follow. You can't favor one party over another. You're supposed to try to maximize competitiveness and things like that. And so, those rules, the software itself is a neutral, right? I mean, it's a great tool to have. It can actually help in many ways, but with somebody with the wrong purpose.
Michael, let me hold you there. We're going to come back to this thought in a moment. We need to take a quick break. We'll keep talking about redistricting after the break. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today on The Exchange, a look at redistricting and gerrymandering. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477 or send us an email to exchange at nhpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter. I have two guests with me today. Rob Boatwright is an associate professor of political science at Clark University. He joins us from Worcester, Mass. And Michael Lee, redistricting counsel for the Brennan Center at the New York University School of Law. And he joins us from New York. Gentlemen, we were talking about technology and how these districts are drawn. And Michael, I left off with you, but Rob, let me get your reactions as well. We all have seen on the web, people who follow politics, these websites that have the, 10 most ridiculously drawn congressional districts. It looks sort of like a Rorschach ink blot. Give me your sense of how this process has progressed.
Well, most of the maps that you see are, these things that people see on the web tend to be maps that are drawn in large population states, states with 10, 15, 20 different districts. And they draw a lot of attention. I think for the most part, most American states don't have that number of districts. And in most states, I think the process works out in a somewhat different way. That is, if you take a look at the New England states, there are many people who are somewhat attached to the culture of their part of the state, and their representative will come from their region of the state. You take New Hampshire, for instance. There are people in New Hampshire who will argue that the two different congressional districts, although they are similar in their level of competitiveness, have somewhat different sorts of identities, right? One sort of tilts towards Portsmouth, the other tilts towards the western part of the state. And so in many instances, legislators will hear input from the public and will try to come up with districts that seem to balance the sort of self-identities of different groups of people. So I think that while the oddly shaped districts get a lot of attention, they're actually a fairly small number of the total number of House seats.
Well, that's really interesting, because what you usually hear about when people talk about redistricting are these kind of crazy quilt districts. Michael, do you agree with that?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I think it works out in most states pretty well. I will say, while people tend to focus on the odd-shaped districts, though, some of the most competitive districts in the country actually are somewhat oddly shaped. So it isn't necessarily there are lots of competing values in redistricting, and that's one of the things that makes it hard.
You're saying it's not just nefarious. There may be other reasons for it.
No, there are lots of, natural communities aren't in squares, right? I mean, they, by and large, so sometimes there's a lake or a mountain, and, and more importantly, in complex states like New York and Texas, you have real communities, which are ethnic communities where people have, that's a core part of their identity. I think if you were in New York and you were African American, you, regardless of what part of the city you live in, you have common interests that other people who are your neighbors may not have. And so, you define your community in part based upon your ethnic identity because of your experiences. And it's not unfair to give that some recognition and in certain instances to create a district that allows that expression.
All right, so I see. So the natural boundaries of a community may not neatly line up with a particular geometric shape, and so that you get this kind of these sort of undulating districts as a result.
Right.
Do you want to jump in, Rob?
Well, I think that's certainly correct. I think the other thing to keep in mind, people spend a lot of time thinking about partisan advantage, but
right.
The way the two parties' coalitions have developed over the past decade is that they're not very evenly geographically distributed.
Right.
Democratic voters tend to be much more concentrated than Republican voters. So on the one hand, one might argue that this gives the parties creative reason to gerrymander, but even if a legislature were genuinely trying to approximate the partisan composition of the state, they would wind up with some very oddly shaped districts due to the sorting of voters.
Right, right. Let's take a phone call. We have Dan joining us from Nashua. Dan, welcome to the Exchange.
Thank you very much. I wanted to raise the issue that I think, while it's easy to get lost in the technical discussion of this issue, and it is a complicated one, I think it isn't basically an abstract issue, that when we have partisan redistricting, as we do in New Hampshire, it effectively amounts to the politicians choosing their voters instead of voters choosing their representatives. And we see that around the country, where over 90% of congressional districts are effectively locked up for one party or the other. Or in 2012, when Democrats won more than a million more votes for Congress, but lost to Congress by a sizable margin. I think that's just basically wrong, and it's not what our founders intended. And I just wanted to further add that I think it's important to see the need for redistricting reform, nonpartisan reform, as part of a larger project of democratic process reforms, which ought to include getting money out of politics, better transparency, dealing with independent spending, because I think ultimately it comes back to, do we, the voters, have confidence in our democratic process, and are these democratic processes actually representative of us?
Dan, let me ask you real briefly, what would be your preferred solution to the redistricting process in New Hampshire?
The organization I represent, Open Democracy, based here in New Hampshire, does advocate for a nonpartisan redistricting commission, similar to what's in use in many other states, where the governor, the heads of both parties in the House and Senate would select representatives, non-elected officials, to sit on such a commission to take public testimony. And because you would have an even number of members from both parties, they would need to compromise. It couldn't be one more vote on one side ramming a proposal through, but you would need compromise by having equal members of both parties serving on the commission and ideally some non-aligned independent members serving as well.
Okay, Dan, let's hear what Michael has to say about your comments. Michael?
Sure. I think Dan hit upon a really important point, which is that redistricting can be hard oftentimes to understand, even for sophisticated people like reporters and very informed citizens. And so oftentimes it gets pitched as a battle between Republicans and Democrats because that's a familiar frame. But it's important to understand the consequences of gerrymandering because what you have to do is you have to think about all of the issues that matter to you and to your community and then imagine that no one in power cares about those issues because you're drawn into a district that with people unlike you. That's really the harm, and that does feed a cynicism about the process. Now, what the ultimate goal is, I think, oftentimes can be hard because one of the challenges of redistricting is that people don't necessarily agree about the goal. Some people think that districts should be competitive, even if that necessarily doesn't – that means drawing kind of districts that are a little bit more or less compact or oddly shaped. Mm-hmm. Some people think that they should look a certain way. Some people think that neighborhoods – keeping them together is the most important thing. So, but I think it's a healthy debate for us to have about – this is a healthy debate, and I'm glad to be part of it.
And, Dan, thanks for calling into the exchange. Gentlemen, I want to talk a little bit about some of the potential problems that we typically hear about when we hear about redistricting. We've talked about some of them, but let's talk about them in a little bit more detail. One of the biggest criticisms that I hear when people criticize the process is the impact on incumbency. And Rob, maybe you could say a little bit about this. And the argument is that essentially redistricting creates safe seats for the parties, which results in kind of the rise of these career politicians. And so is that a legitimate criticism or is that overblown?
It is legitimate. There should certainly be the potential for competition. I don't know, again, given the restrictions on the redistricting process that are imposed by how populations are distributed, I don't know that competition should always be the guiding concern. I think one way to think about this, and this sort of plays off of what our last caller had said, members of Congress or members of the legislature will develop expertise in the policy areas that affect a particular community. So, for instance, you have a legislator who has spent a decade or more trying to secure appropriations for, cleaning up a polluted part of the district or doing something else that, they have a long history of doing. That should be a concern in the redistricting process, right? We shouldn't just say, well, this person is an incumbent, they should have competition. We should make sure that there is some continuity for voters and for the representatives. And there are many complicated things that influence the re-election of incumbents. Redistricting certainly protects some incumbents, but there are many other components of the incumbency advantage. So we certainly shouldn't single out redistricting and say this is the primary culprit.
I just want to tell our listeners again, we're talking about redistricting today in the U.S. political process. And you can join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. So, Michael, we see these congressional districts where, the same party is incumbent from the same party is elected 60-65% of the vote. And I understand Rob is saying that it's not always due to redistricting. How do you see that breakdown? Is it, do you think it's driven by redistricting or is it other considerations like expertise and just being a good politician, let's say?
Well, I certainly think that there are places in the country where incumbent protection is the driving force behind redistricting. California, before they created their redistricting commission, that was certainly the case. In California, you didn't so much have partisan gerrymandering trying to give one party an advantage or another. What you had was a bipartisan agreement that everybody's seat would be protected. And indeed, in California, in the couple of decades before creating the commission, I think only one incumbent actually lost. And so that is as much, sometimes that is a very deliberate choice and it results in districts that are drawn to keep out your opponents and to, you know, otherwise, you know, draw in people who are more likely to support you. And so it's what Dan, the caller earlier, described as politicians picking their voters. That certainly does occur. It doesn't occur all the time, and it's not the only reason why members of Congress get reelected, but it certainly is an issue in many states.
Yeah, and Rob, you mentioned a moment ago the issue of competitive districts, that not necessarily the only goal in redistricting. So one of the criticisms that I often hear is that because of redistricting, you have fewer competitive districts. Fewer competitive districts means sort of fewer middle-of-the-road politicians winning office, and so the result is that you have these high reelection rates of a Congress that is more ideologically polarized than the population as a whole. Is that fair or not?
Well, it's a plausible story. There's been a lot of research on the sorts of politicians who emerge from competitive districts, however. And over the past decade or two, there's actually fairly little evidence that people who come from politically competitive districts are more moderate. You see this in the case of the Republican Party, for instance. There are no moderates left in the House of Representatives from the Republican Party, regardless of the competitiveness of their district. But in addition, if people have to worry about reelection every cycle, they often wind up having to worry a great deal about raising money from often very partisan groups outside of their district. So certainly it makes sense, again, to encourage competitiveness, but we shouldn't necessarily look at competitiveness as somehow akin to moderation or willing to compromise. Mm-hmm.
And Michael, do you buy the polarization argument that I laid out?
You know, I think that, there certainly is polarization. I'm not sure that I would say that redistricting is responsible for all of it, or that redistricting could solve all of that simply by making districts more competitive.
Let's go back to the phones now, and we have Jay joining us from Salem. Jay, welcome to the Exchange.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to add something here. I lived in New Hampshire now for the last 12 years, but I moved from Wisconsin, where I pretty much grew up. And they had a process there that had been done by commission, and it was a nonpartisan commission that looked at things around rather geographically concentrated districts. And I'm not just talking about districts at the congressional level, but that for the state legislature itself. And over the period of time since I've been here, while corresponding with relatives still back in Wisconsin, they bemoaned the fact that the legislature redistricted itself to where their districts now are these sinewy things that run tendrils all across the state. You could be living in the city of Milwaukee and be in a representative district for the state that could go 35 miles to the west and to have a representative that actually sits in a small town of East Troy, where it doesn't make any sense other than it's a way that the legislature can ensure its power for the future to allow it to then control such issues as congressional redistricting when it comes in, because they abolished the commission. And I thought it was a very equitable way of doing things when the commission was in place, but I'm seeing now that it's just literally a power grab, and that's what the result is, what you can see in Wisconsin now.
Thank you, Jay. Rob and Michael, we've talked primarily about congressional districts so far. Jay raises this issue, and we've had it here in New Hampshire where, you know, you have redistricting as well. We have in New Hampshire executive councilors, state senators, state representatives. So this is not just a congressional issue. Rob, let me have your thoughts on Jay's call.
Well, Jay is certainly right that I think state legislators have much more of an ability to draw districts that advantage themselves. In the case of the U.S. House of Representatives, of course, members of Congress have to communicate their preferences to state legislators. They can't actually make the decisions themselves. So I think that's certainly true. I think the problem with that scenario is that certainly we'd look at a lot of oddly shaped districts and say that they don't necessarily always represent communities of interest or any sort of definable community at all that somebody might connect with. We've talked a little bit about the problems with an overemphasis on geography, however. Another way to think about this is that if you legislate that districts be compact, for instance, there's no mathematical standard we can use, right? It's hard to mandate any sort of rules about compactness.
Michael, you've done looked at some issues at local level as well. Is this as big an issue as the congressional redistricting? Do we just overlook it, or does it get a fair bit of attention?
Well, I think certainly there's a lot of gerrymandering that goes on at the local level, in part because of people who are drawing the lines. You know, it's one thing when legislators draw congressional lines. You know, certainly people care about who controls Congress, but when it's their own livelihood that's at stake and their own political future, they are oftentimes very careful, maybe that's the word to use, about doing that. And in fact, you know, legislators are, you know, one of the great advantages of having legislators draw lines that they are certainly subject matter experts in their communities. You know, they know which voters will vote a certain way, which voters won't turn out, and all of that. And so, you know, certainly in places like Texas and elsewhere, you see a lot of gerrymandering, both to advantage a party and to protect incumbents at the state level. And so there's a lot of interest in reform at that level as well.
So just to be clear, Michael, the process at the local level, basically in terms of timing and procedure, essentially the same as congressional redistricting?
Very, very much the same. Sometimes they move on slightly different cycles depending on when states have their legislative elections, but you know, that it's every 10 years and then the new lines get drawn.
You mentioned Texas. Just before we go to a break, I recall there was a situation in Texas, I think it was in the early 2000s, where Republicans wanted to pass redistricting and Democrats literally left the state to prevent a quorum from being reached. Is that correct?
That's right. They actually left a couple of times. The House left one time and the Senate left another time. So that was probably a little bit more dramatic than most, but certainly it shows you how passionate people feel about this and you know, how much is at stake.
Yeah, I think they went across the border into Oklahoma or something like that, and they were not allowed to set foot back into the state because they were going to be escorted directly to the floor of the state legislature for this redistricting.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, we got to take one more break, but when we come back, we're going to continue talking about congressional redistricting. I want to look at some of the voting rights cases around this, and we'll also talk about the future reform. So more on redistricting in a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Tomorrow on The Exchange, Iranian-United States relations. Send us an email before the show at exchange@nhpr.org or find us on Twitter or Facebook. But today we're talking about redistricting, and you can join us by phone, calling in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email us, exchange@nhpr.org. I have two guests with me today for the hour, Rob Boatwright, an associate professor of political science at Clark University in Worcester, and Michael Lee, redistricting counsel for the Brennan Center at New York University Law School. And Michael joins us from New York. And gentlemen, let's go back to the phones. We have Dorothy joining us from Leominster. Dorothy, welcome to The Exchange.
Yes, the way the gerrymandering works, as you've been describing, is that you get these little twists and turns in it, all trying to make sure that the areas will all fit politically. And my opinion is, and I think it should be in the Constitution, that the districts should be, yes, they're based on population, therefore rural areas will have larger ones, but they should be basically the same shape, so that as the population changes in one area, that's when you'll change the district. If an area gets more population, then it will become a little bit smaller, but it will still be reasonably the same shape. You will be getting different views. It won't be based on people's opinions on, you know, for political opinions. It will be based strictly on population, so that each district will have a variation in in how they vote.
Dorothy, let's go to our experts. Rob, what do you think? Geographical uniformity, is it doable?
I don't know that it's doable. People are not distributed uniformly, and you know, again, as we've talked about, in some cases you'll have a mountain range or a river or something that effectively cuts off one region of a state from another. So there are a lot of very complex decisions that go into the making of congressional districts, and certainly I think a legislature would want to make districts look like there's nothing suspicious going on, but it's very hard to do that.
It would be very hard to do indeed. Gentlemen, I want to talk a little bit. Oh, and Dorothy, thank you again for calling in. Gentlemen, I want to talk a little bit about redistricting from the perspective of voting rights. We hear about redistricting potentially negatively impacting voting rights, particularly for minority groups like African Americans and Latinos. Others have argued that it's a way of potentially helping to preserve representation for these groups. Let's begin, Michael, with you. You've done some work in this area from a legal perspective. The connection between redistricting and voting rights.
Well, the Voting Rights Act is, as I said, one of the key laws that it actually is enforced to in the redistricting arena. There aren't a lot of constraints against partisan gerrymandering, but there is a robust set of laws dealing with the protection of minorities. It certainly is something that the court seems to be retreating from a little bit. You know, the Supreme Court is increasingly seems to be uncomfortable with the idea of race and racial remedies. You see that not only in redistricting, but in affirmative action and a number of other areas. And so, you know, query whether that is going to remain the case. There was a case in the Supreme Court this term dealing with arguable racial gerrymander in Alabama, and we'll see whether the court actually uses that to police the process or not.
Am I correct? There's also a case in Arizona as well that's going to be at the Supreme Court?
There is, although that does not involve race. It just involves who gets to draw the lines, whether you could have a commission in the first place or not.
Oh, I see. So you make an important distinction there between protecting minority groups versus the parties using this to kind of hardwire in partisan an advantage. It sounds like the courts are more willing to get involved in cases where, although you're saying they're backing away a little bit, but potentially more involved when there is sort of the potential for individual groups' voting rights to be violated. Is that correct, Michael?
That's correct. Historically, they've been more involved. What you saw this last redistricting cycle, particularly in the South, is a lot of people, actually white Republicans, using the Voting Rights Act sort of as an excuse to draw districts in a certain way, which minority groups have then contended actually hurt them. In other words, what they did in Alabama and in other states like North Carolina and Texas was pack minorities into districts using the Voting Rights Act as an excuse, even though if you left them outside of that, minorities would actually have influence over a larger number of districts and thus have more political power. And so that's a problem of pretext. Mm-hmm. It's really the problem of excuse, and the question is whether the Supreme Court is going to look at that closely or just turn a blind eye.
And there was this decision recently regarding the voting rights where in the past certain states had to pre-clear changes with the Justice Department. That's no longer the case. Is that correct?
That's right. Up until June 2013, a number of states, 16 states, mostly in the South, but also including 10 towns, a few towns in New Hampshire historically, had to get changes to their election laws, including redistricting plans approved. The Supreme Court struck that down, saying that the formula used to determine what states were covered was too outdated and that it needed to be updated, which in the ordinary case would be nothing. They would just update it. But, of course, Congress, being Congress, has not managed to do that. So,
mm-hmm. Hey, Rob, your take on the intersection between redistricting and voting rights.
Well, Michael's the authority on the law here. Right. In terms of effect, I think the difficult calculation is if somebody who is sincerely advocating for the election of African-American or Latino representatives wants to play a role in drawing districts, it's hard to figure out what the magic number is. So these cases that Michael is referring to in a state like Alabama, certainly a district that is approaching 100% minority is going to elect a minority. But there's been a lot of research over the past couple decades on what the prognosis is for a congressional district that is, say, 45 or 50% minority, or how we should think about a district that is let's say, minority white, but has has a large group of, say, Latino voters, African-American voters, that is, has no clear majority group. So things get rather complicated when we start thinking about results as opposed to just thinking about which groups have the minority and have the majority in a district.
So we've described this very complex process over almost the last hour. Sort of the end issue here to discuss really is reform. And so we'll talk a little bit about reform now. But let me begin with kind of a very basic question to each of you. And I'll start with you, Rob. Do you think reform is necessary?
To some extent. It's not necessarily clear what sort of reforms will work. But I think that this decade is proving to be rather interesting because, again, the technology is available to pretty much everybody to scrutinize state plans. And in addition, Michael and I have both spoken a little bit about commissions. This decade we'll have much more experience with commissions in a variety of different states. So, for instance, back in the 1970s, something we touched on a little while ago, Iowa and New Jersey were the two states that used commissions, and it was easy to take a look and say, well, these states are not like the rest of the United States, right? So whatever their commissions do have more to do with the particular politics of Iowa and New Jersey than they do with the rest of the country. So the more variety we see in states that adopt this, the more we'll be able to see whether it is possible to change the process and what the results are.
Mm-hmm. Michael, do you think it's necessary?
I think the jury is still out about what type of reforms work best, but I think certainly allowing states the freedom to experiment and to figure out ways to deal with a problem that lots of people think exists is a good thing, and hopefully the Supreme Court doesn't take that away by saying that you can't have commissions to do congressional redistricting in the Arizona case. But I certainly think, there's a lot of interest. I think we've seen a renewed interest in reform in places like Ohio, Indiana, Nebraska. You've seen over half a dozen redistricting bills already filed. And a lot of these efforts, unlike past efforts, actually seem like they may have some traction. And I think that's in part because of a growing bipartisan recognition that there is a problem with this. It's not a Democrat versus Republican issue. Democrats do it just as much as Republicans, but that it, there is some pernicious effect from all of this, and that people need to figure out a way to try to solve it.
So, Michael, just to clarify, what would be the argument for the Supreme Court to say you can't use a commission?
Well, Arizona created a commission through a ballot initiative, and in many of the states where you have commissions, like California, they were created by ballot initiatives because politicians themselves won't do it. They have a vested interest in not creating a commission. And what Arizona is arguing is that the Constitution doesn't allow voters of a state to use a ballot initiative to take redistricting power away.
I see.
And that's that, in short, is the argument, and the court will hear that next week.
So the issue is not about using a commission. It's about the voters using a ballot initiative to establish the commission.
Well, it's both about that, and then they're also arguing that the maps themselves have to have substantial legislative involvement. And so in California and Arizona, when the commissioner adopts a map, that becomes the map. In other states, like New York, there is a commission that will draw a map, but then the legislature gets to approve that. And so they're actually arguing two things, that you can't use a ballot initiative to create it, and then even if beyond that, the legislature still has to retain a role. So,
mm-hmm. And Rob, a couple of my colleagues here asked me a very interesting hypothetical question. I don't know that there's an answer to it, but I'm going to pose it to both of you. What would or should an ideal congressional district look like?
I don't know if there's a correct answer to that. I think that,
What are the competing concerns that should go into deciding this?
I think the odd thing about Congress is that members of the U.S. House of Representatives, they're the only people who represent that particular group of voters, right? Congressional districts don't necessarily correspond, except for, except in the case of one district states, to the district of anybody else. So that creates an odd form of expertise, right? It creates these sort of artificial communities. So I think wherever possible, it would be a good thing for legislative seats to correspond to the boundaries of, let's say, towns, cities, counties, some other sort of recognizable political entity.
Sort of long-established towns and villages,
et cetera.
Yeah, but,
you know, that's a matter of how the population is distributed. Again, that's not something that can be legislated at all.
Right. Michael, an ideal congressional district?
I think that's a pretty hard question, but what I would say is that, you know, there certainly is a range of reasonable choices that you could make. This is not a binary choice between, you know, acceptable and unacceptable. In having sat through many redistricting hearings, one of the complaints, though, that you hear often is that my neighborhood was split up, or the town is split up, or our town is divided into five different districts. And so, you know, by and large, people tend to view their communities in geographic terms. And I would agree with Rob that preserving that, probably people may not like the district, but they would understand it and they would feel less cynical about it if, in fact, the districts are sort of more natural. The one exception, of course, being ethnic communities, which oftentimes cross over those boundaries and are, you know, very real districts to African Americans and Latinos. Or very real communities to African Americans and Latinos, and so that's a competing concern. But by and large, I would say, you know, focusing on geographic components is a healthy start.
They're more natural boundaries.
Yes.
So, you know, over the past hour, both of you have described this kind of, you know, complex set of issues. It's not quite as cut and dry as people may think. It gets a little supercharged in the political arena. You know, it's not all good. It's not all bad. I think it's a nicely nuanced picture that you've painted. But I want to end with getting a reaction to it. I read an article this morning about how the Democrats have already set up a PAC and chosen an individual to lead the effort for 2020. And their argument is, you know, there are too many Republican state legislatures and Republican governors. Democrats need to flip those and then redistrict so the Democrats have more seats. So, Rob, kind of what is your reaction to that, given sort of the larger kind of legal issues we've discussed? I mean, is this issue just going to continue to heat up? Where are we kind of in sort of the ebb and flow of the politics of this?
Well, the Democrats very correctly so, have learned from 2010 that partisan control of legislatures matters a lot. The Democrats certainly lost a number of seats, had a number of the Republican gains of 2010 locked in because Republicans won state legislatures in this landslide year for the party. So the Democrats will be looking at state legislatures that they might be able to tip if they invest the right amount of money, and will be trying to invest very heavily in candidate recruitment. It's a basic part of political competition, and it certainly is all about what the map that guides the 2022 election looks like. But I think it's also, you know, before we say, oh, this is just partisan jockeying, I think it's a valuable thing to have the national parties interested in the composition of state legislatures. And, you know, we've seen this, you know, particularly in the case of what the Democratic Party sought to do in, you know, following the 2004 election. To the extent that the parties seek to reach out and develop, let's say, a farm team in places where they've not historically been competitive, this can be a good thing for the country in the long run.
Michael, real quick, we only have about 45 seconds. Your reaction to this kind of big partisan initiative by the Democrats?
Well, I think it certainly in some ways makes a case for redistricting reform, right? Because 2010 was a midterm election and thus a year that favors Republicans. 2020, when the census next takes place, is a Democratic year, or the election right before the round of redistricting is a Democratic year because it's a presidential year. And so, you know, you'll constantly have this back and forth, it seems, unless you find a different way of doing this.
Well, gentlemen, we are out of time, unfortunately. I know we're still 5 years away from the next census, but obviously there's going to be plenty to watch in the states and in the courts over the next 5 years. I'd like to thank my guests, Rob Boatwright and Michael Lee, for joining us this morning. Rob, thanks so much for joining us. That's Robert Boatwright, Associate Professor of Political Science at Clark University. He joined us from Worcester, Mass. And Michael, we really appreciate you joining us this morning as well.
Had a great time.
Thanks. That's Michael Lee, Legal Counsel for the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University Law School. He joined us from New York. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Jason Moon. Our intern is Dylan Morrill. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy.